everyone. Good morning. Good morning, and welcome once again to our weekly Sunrise Project call. I am happy that we are all here this morning on this beautiful Easter morning in this safe space filled with love and compassion and a mutual desire to heal ourselves. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I am so honored and delighted to have with us this morning my dear friend, Dee Sapp. She is an author, a nonprofit founder, executive director, consultant, volunteer, board member, and a mental health and disability advocate. Dee is currently serving her second term as chair of the Maryland Developmental Disabilities Council, first appointed by Governor Larry Hogan and then reappointed to an additional 5-year term by Governor Wes Moore to continue her work advocating for people with disabilities in the state of Maryland. Dee advocates for reforms at the Maryland Motor Vehicle Administration, which is the MVA, and her work has led to changes in the learner's permit test, a driver's manual rewritten in plain language, which is now being offered in 9 additional languages. Dee has also provided both written and oral testimony for issues surrounding driver safety, privacy, and police training. Most recently, Dee was appointed to the Charles County Commission on Individuals with Disabilities, and in January 2025, she was elected to the board of directors for the Charles County Chamber of Commerce and recently nominated for another appointment from Governor Moore's office to the State Early Childhood Advisory Council, which holds a 5 to 10 year term. That's so major, Dee. Congratulations on that. Dee is a board member for Down Syndrome Sports of America and is a graduate of Penn State University with a Bachelor of Science degree in Human Development and Family Studies. Her most notable achievement is being a mother to 3 beautiful children, one of which is a 2-time Paralympian with autism and an intellectual disability. And I mentioned she is an executive director. She is the executive director of the Sunrise Project, and we are so proud and honored to have Dee leading the way with the Sunrise Project. So appreciate you, Dee, and thank you for being here today to discuss autism acceptance, a mother's perspective. So welcome and good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Kelly.
I want to start with this is Autism Acceptance Month, April is, and you have been such an incredible advocate for people with disabilities, even recently working with us on our Easter Seals campaign around disability pride. So let's start with your journey, how it started, how long you've been leading and championing for your son, your beautiful son Lawrence, who has autism.
Yes. So he was diagnosed with a developmental delay when he was 2. And it was normal, I guess. Excited to see you, Dr. Vicky. It was normal at that time for a 2-year-old to not meet those developmental milestones, according to the pediatrician. And every year that we went back for his checkups, they were like, well, boys are slower, boys will take time. It just kept getting pushed and pushed and pushed. I noticed, I want to say when he was, well, maybe like around 2, just before he turned 2, he wasn't speaking. And I took him to Kennedy Krieger, where that's where he was diagnosed there. But with supports, they said that he would be able to catch up. And so we moved to where we are now, Charles County, when he was 4, so that he could be in an inclusive program. I didn't want him to be in a contain we at the time we were in Prince George's County, and the school that was close to us only had special education programs, not inclusion. And so we moved and built our home in Charles County because I really felt that he would be able to thrive in an inclusive program. But fast forward, when he was
Hey, Dee, can you just pause on that? Did somebody recommend that for you? Or how did you know? Or how did you feel so strongly? Like, what prompted you to say, I think it's best for Lawrence to be in an inclusive environment
okay, so I
versus
didn't know
special ed?
anything. And what's crazy is I don't ever remember them using the word disability. They just said developmentally delayed. And I was Kennedy Krieger is in Baltimore. At the time, we lived in Prince George's County, and I was driving back and forth 2 to 3 times a week to Kennedy Krieger. And the occupational therapist and the team that was seeing him there said, well, they have programs inside of schools that he could actually go to get these supports so that you don't have to drive back and forth. And that's when originally I looked into the program that was closer to our home, which was in Prince George's County. And when we were there was somebody that was telling us that they had that there were 3 new schools that were being built in Charles County where they had inclusion programs in the school. And so I learned it by talking talking to other people, and it just came out in a conversation. And because I was annoyed, the program that he was in, it was during the summer, so it was like a 2 hour a day something. And the only thing he wasn't really doing was talking, but he was at the time I had one other child, and I was a stay-at-home mom, and we were in play groups, and he was playing with everybody. Everything other than the verbal aspect seemed completely normal to me. And so when I took him to this program, the daily reports that I got, they would say, oh, he fed himself today. He went to the potty. But I'd already done those things. Like, he was potty trained earlier than my daughter, who's 2 years older than him. He was a chunky one, and he was eating sausages with his fat fingers and everything early on. Like, he had already met those milestones, and he had that going into the program. And they were like, oh, he used a fork today. I'm like, I know. So the daily reports that I was getting were things that he already knew how to do, and he wasn't making any progress there. And he just seemed, and those seemed like huge milestones for that program. And I was like, this isn't working. And so when I found out about the programs in Charles County, that's when we moved here, and I made sure that our home was built in a zone to where he could go to those schools. So however they
Got it.
iced up the plan, he was going to go to these 3 schools so that he could get those supports. But I got it from
Got it.
just like here, talking to other people and making those decisions.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you. That's very helpful. But keep going. You were talking about your journey and how it started. And
Yeah,
so
so that's
now,
how it started. But what's I'm not even going to say funny. So IEP meetings every single year, all through elementary school. When he was in the 6th grade, so he started swimming during the summer, summer swim. And that was a life skill. I mean, what a lot of people don't know is that many children with autism who elope towards water, it usually results in a death or drowning. And for whatever reason, when they elope, they go towards water. So it was a life-saving skill for him to learn how to swim. And so at 4, we joined a summer aquatics club, and there he learned how to swim. But by the 6th grade, he wanted more competitive swimming, and we were traveling to NCAP, where he still swims in the 6th grade. And at the time, I was working at Georgetown University. And I live in Southern Maryland, and I would go to work late. My hours were like from 10 to 3. I would put him on the bus because he wanted to ride the school bus. And then I would go to work in DC, leave work early, come back, get him off the bus, and then be with him because I was home, when he was before he went to school. But I made sure that I was home when he went to school and when he came back. So when he was in middle school, I tried to find something that would work. And the lab school is right around the corner from Georgetown, where my office was. And the lab school is a private school for students with learning disabilities. But that school had a swim team, it had pool, it had like all the things that I thought were great. And I was like, okay, this is good. He can swim. And as you know, American University, NCAP has a location there. I had it all worked out. And then he could just come to work with me. And I could work longer hours because I was looking at upward mobility for my job and all these other things. And so the interview and everything with the lab school, well, the conversation I had with them went great. And they said that the only thing we need to make sure we have an educational evaluation for him, because we do not accept students that have intellectual disabilities. And so they said, we can test him, or you can go somewhere else and have him tested. But I was like, oh, we'll have, I'll get him tested. And I knew that was not an issue because he just had a developmental delay. And I was like, he doesn't have an intellectual disability. He doesn't have autism, and we'll get it done. We got the testing done. Test came back, said he had an intellectual disability. First time I heard disability. Like, he had been in school from pre-K. So he was 3 years old when he first entered, no, three, because he did pre-K. Because we came in through the early intervention program. So pre-K twice, I think, and then kindergarten once because of his birthday, if I'm correct. And all the way through sixth grade, disability never was ever used. It was just developmental delay.
The word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the word was actually never used. Mm-hmm. And so when this psychologist, the person that tested him, said that he had an intellectual disability, I was like, wait, what? Like, that's when I was like, what's going on here? And, they mentioned that his cognitive function was below a certain level and whatever. And it didn't make sense to me because he was like 12, at that point. And so how do you go from me being at Kennedy Krieger when he was 2 or 3 years old all the way to 12? And this went completely undetected he was the same person the next day, but this changed a complete trajectory simply because, and that's when I was just like really on fire. Like, I went from being like, we can overcome this to we don't have enough time, and that's when I really turned into a spitfire because I was angry at everybody in the school system, because this isn't, I was like, this isn't right. We have these IEP meetings every single year. I'm a stay at home. I was a stay at home mom. I was volunteering at the school all the time. I dropped him off, picked him up, and there's a law called Child Find where the schools are
child. What? What's it called?
Find.
Okay. F-I-N-D. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Where they're supposed to assess and, recommend students be tested for certain things. And it just never happened. And so at this point, that's when, I went all in with testing. And because I was at Georgetown, I had neurological testing done. We did, when I showed up at those IEP meetings, like, we completely changed everything. And that was the beginning of where we are now and
the whole journey. Can you explain for people IEP if someone doesn't know, or maybe this is a new journey for them? IEP versus the 504, or are they the same?
They're different. So the IEP is an individualized education plan, and that is actually considered a legal document that they get when they're in school. So that only is applicable, so to speak, when they're in school, because it provides access to, I would say, federally funded. A lot of people don't know that the public schools are federally funded. And so so that is basically an agreement between a family and the schools of what support your child will get when they're in the school. A 504 allows for you to get certain level of support, but it is not a legally binding document. It's usually not as intense. 504s are usually accommodations that they'll give, like extended time.
Sitting in the front of the classroom.
Exactly.
Notes in
bigger print, or they'll get just easily accommodatable. But the IEP allows for modifications to an assignment. It allows for supports. It allows for assistive technology. Like, it's a whole, by the time my son graduated, I want to say his IEP was like 80 pages, because I wanted to write it down. I was like, put this in there. Put this in there.
That's so good. I think we had a 504 for both of my sons, but I don't think we ever had an IEP. Definitely a
Yeah, you would have
504 with
known. Yeah.
accommodations. Yeah, I would have known. Okay. Very interesting. So talk a little bit more about your journey in the swimming world, because that's where we met, many, many
Yeah.
years ago. And swimming is already very isolating, for Black children. Very few of us. We could always find our kids in the pool, at most big meets, especially. Can you share what that may have been like? And I know that you started with Lawrence as a summer swimmer and then moved him into a big competitive space. Ultimately, he's a two-time Paralympian. But share, your journey as mom. We've sat at meets together, we've been there together. Share some of the things you may have had to deal with Lawrence as a Paralympian.
So, summer swim, everything was great. Everybody was very accepting. And again, at that point, he didn't have a disability. I mean, like, I wasn't telling people that he, because, he didn't. And kids were just kids then, they didn't notice anything different. And there wasn't a reason for me to explain or justify anything. We came to NCAP when Lawrence, again, was in the sixth grade. And he was new then. And that was, and I did explain to the coaches then that he had, he was recently diagnosed with an intellectual disability, no autism. He had not been diagnosed with autism at this point in the sixth grade. And, but the process for him was the same for interviewing for the team, because as you know, NCAP has different sites, different levels, and based on the level you swim at, dictates what time you swim with them. And we went to the Mount Vernon location, I believe, and he tried out for them. And they were like, he may want to go to our other site, the more competitive site. That's where like our national team swimmers and all this stuff. And he was in the sixth grade then. And I was like, okay, we'll do that. And that's when I learned that they trained at 4:30 a.m., which is crazy to me.
Yes, fun
We
filled.
did. Oh my
Crazy town.
gosh. I was like, what is happening here? But they just took him in. It was like, no sweat. And he was training with Paul Macon. I love him to pieces. And Lawrence swam with him. Within, I want to say, the first 6 months of him training with Paul, we received an email from the United States. Well, at the time, it was just USOC, the United States Olympic Committee. And they said, "We understand that you have a USA swimmer that has a disability. We would like to talk to you about Paralympic swimming." I had never heard anything about Paralympic swimming at all. And I want to say they sent us like two letters, and I didn't pay attention to the first one, but the second one I did open, and this was ahead of Rio. And they were like bringing him to a meet, he can meet everyone. And we did. It was in Indianapolis. We went to that meet, and people from all over the world were there. And I was like, what is this? Like, this was like our first, exposure to the world of swimming, like past national, like world. People from Canada, I'm trying to think, Japan, Korea. And this was like on, US soil. So I was like, this is insane. And he swam really well competitively at that meet. And I was like, okay, this may be a thing. And Paul traveled with us to that meet. And like years later, kind of fast forwarding, he moved up to Jeff's group, which is where he is right now. And there were a handful of times where there were issues with other swimmers between my son and the swimmer, but not because of, anything that my son did. They didn't understand why my son got special treatment. And the special treatment was Lawrence, when a set got hard, Lawrence would hop out of the water and go to the bathroom, like he would leave. And some of the other swimmers were getting mad. Like, they started treating him some kind of way because they said that he was cheating. He wasn't completing sets. And one of the moms called me, because I had complained to the coach. And then one of the moms called me directly, and she was like, "D, look, the kids don't understand why Lawrence gets to do this, why Lawrence get, he doesn't finish the sets, but he still gets to lead the lane, because in swimming, the faster swimmers usually set the pace for the lane." And I told her, I said, "Well, you're the best thing you can do." She was like, "Well, what do I tell my son?" the best thing you can tell him is to worry about himself. You know, he's
That's right.
there to swim for himself and not worry about what anybody else is doing. But because you called me, I'm going to explain to you that that's considered an accommodation. You know, my son is autistic. I mean, he has an intellectual disability and he does have some sensory issues. When he gets overwhelmed, he needs space. And what he is doing is using the tools that he was given to go
Yes.
back, recalibrate, and come back in. And those sets are overwhelming because for people that don't know swimming, when the coach starts spitting out, you know, what to swim, you know, what the set times, the I can't think, it's
Right.
not the frequencies, but you know what it is.
Yeah. 4 by 100 and then 5 by 12,
On the
whatever.
25 and on the
Yeah.
like, it's just a lot and not a lot of time on the wall to think and then move on. And so we had an agreement with the coach that when Lawrence feels overwhelmed, he can just hop out, go get a drink of water, go to the bathroom, come back, and then he's completely centered because generally they melt down. Like, you know, they have a complete meltdown when they're overwhelmed and they don't have the words to use. And so that was the agreement they had, and it wasn't disruptive. You know, just when you're feeling
Right.
overwhelmed, get out, go, and the rest of the team keeps going. But that's not what the team saw. You know, they just saw him, they thought he was cheating, and then getting back in was warmer. So anyway, talking to the mom, when I explained that to her, she was like, I didn't know. And you know, but just kind of like, now you do. And
Right.
that and then it was somewhat fine after that. Like there was the time that I mentioned to you that, you know, he was faster than some of the other kids. And at one of the meets, there was a dad that said, "You let a disabled person beat you." And I remember this was a check. I was not happy with that. But then, you know, we have safe sport and all these other rules about parents, how parents are supposed to act on
Yeah,
check
that's unacceptable.
and you know, and all these things. And I realized that that's how they saw him, you know, not everybody. And this, and mind you, the people at meets aren't just the people that they train with. You know, there are other teams that come from other areas. But when I heard this dad say that, I was like, this is how they see him. They don't, you know, some people see him as a competitor, as you know, like they all do, just somebody
Right.
race. And then somebody saw him, they measured their success against how they perform against somebody that they see as less than. And that was terrible. But what
Yeah.
I can say about his swim club, his coach, the entire NCAP, period, the entire club, all sites, they are no nonsense when it comes to the foolishness. You know,
That's
they are
right.
very protective of him, and they set the tone for how he is going to be treated. And I don't know, they said it once at our location, but like even Chris's coach, your son's coach, like he knows Lawrence. Well, my son's never swam for him, but him and his son, when they see him on deck, you know, everybody knows that's Lawrence. You know, they
Yes.
speak to him, they and that's what acceptance is. You know, like
That is
it
what
doesn't need
acceptance is.
special training. It doesn't need, it's not punitive. It doesn't take anything away from anyone else. It's just treating people with, you know, respect and dignity and then, you know, letting it go.
Right, which is so interesting because there's this word, ableism, which is quite the opposite of acceptance. I would love for you to talk about that, ableism. What is it? How do we make sure that people don't fall into that and don't behave with an ableist attitude? Can you share about
Yeah, so
ableism?
ableism is like a marker that people use when interacting, or I say judging a person with a disability. You are
Right.
assessing their ability to do things based on your understanding of how things are done, not based on their best ability or how they do things. And I think this is my personal belief. There's a very fine line between what I call that toxic positivity and ableism, you know, advocating and saying that people can do more. I mean, people with disabilities are able to do more and really believing that versus you being very ableistic and
Right.
expecting them to do more. So let me give you an example of how those two things are different. You know, me saying, you know, people with disabilities are able to do more than what you think they can do. Like there are people like the whole thing that just came out with RFK, like that was craziness. There's a difference between saying they can't do anything. We know, like saying that
Right.
they'll never pay taxes, they'll never do. No, they already have proven that they do pay taxes. Like there are, you know,
That's
they
right.
can drive. Like my son just got his driver's license. There are things that they're able to do, but in that moment,
That's right.
in the moment when someone is maybe emotionally dysregulated, or in the moment where you know, someone that maybe has a physical disability and they can't do something, in that moment when you know that they can't do it and someone is saying, oh, you can do it, you just don't want to, or I've seen other people with your disability who do this, like you're measuring them against something that you think that they should be able to do, not based on what this individual can actually do in this moment. So it's a that's an ableist attitude versus being positive. And people think that they're being positive by saying, it's okay, you can do it. Like, would you say that to someone in a wheelchair and you wanted them to get up and run a mile or walk? You know, if they're saying,
Right.
you know, I can't do this, you wouldn't say, you can do anything you set your mind to. You know, like that's silly. You know, you think you're being,
Right.
you, I mean, you would never say that to a person in a wheelchair, but it's the same thing for people with invisible disabilities. Someone
Right.
dealing with arthritis, or someone that's dealing with MS, or any other non-visible conditions, you know, if people are in pain, like they don't have to tell you that they're in pain. If they're telling you that they can't do something, you have to believe them and accept, you know, accept where it is. You know, if it's
That's
having a
right.
mental crisis, you know, to dismiss it, it's very ableistic, you know, to
Right.
dismiss someone's pain to, you know, their situation.
And most people, honestly, most of us don't understand. You know, we did this work, as you know, you were a consultant on the work we did for Easter Seals recently, and the initiative was called Disability is Not a Dirty Word. You know, the word disability, and the concept is not a dirty word. That was the name of the campaign. And really, disability pride. You know, we have t-shirts that say disability is not a dirty word. I wear that with such pride all the time. But I think it's about learning about it, being comfortable saying it, and then sharing and making, you know, realizing that people are people. You know, people are people. And I shared this story maybe a year ago when you were here with Lawrence. I think it's been just about a year ago. And Chris called in and talked about it because it was a beautiful story that you shared about dropping our sons off at practice. And they were swimming some big meet together at the University of Maryland. And you dropped off Lawrence, and I dropped off Chris and went somewhere to park. And Chris saw him and stood outside in the cold, waiting for him to come in so they could come in together. And your comment was, you know, Lawrence would have this huge smile on his face because a lot of times people don't talk with him, or they, you know, they isolate him, unfortunately. And Chris made a comment. He said, "I didn't know Lawrence was disabled." He said, "He's just my friend."
Yeah, you're
And
gonna make me
I
cry
thought,
again.
yeah, but that me too, because I remember thinking like he swam against Chris for years and Kyle. You know, for many, many years, they didn't think about the fact that they didn't know he had autism. They just thought, that's Lawrence. He's cool. He's quiet. Chris is quiet too. Chris is a person of very few words. And so that being able to, you know, a lot of us, I will share a personal story. Like when you see somebody in a wheelchair, you know, make eye contact and smile, you know, or visible disability, make eye contact and smile. So many of us avoid that, or we don't know how to speak or what to do because we don't want to be offensive. But what I learned through all this working with you, Dee, especially, and doing work with marginalized communities, that's all we do, is there's such power in speaking it, saying it, celebrating it, and not running from it, not avoiding it. And so you do such a tremendous job, as a disability advocate and as an incredible mom. How do you deal, or what, I think a different question. How can communities become more autism friendly? How can we do better as a community, particularly with autism, since this is Autism Acceptance Month?
At Lawrence didn't get diagnosed with autism until he was a junior in high school. And this, kind of sent me back to that space that I was in the sixth grade. I'm like, how did we miss this? I mean, which means that he got no services for autism in his youth. And so I had to quickly do something. But I'm going to share like a recent story and then give an example of how I managed this. So as recent as last week, this happened. So I found, like, I'm trying to find a tribe for him to what you're saying. Like, all he wants is friends. He really wants friends. He wants somebody to call him, to just check in on him, someone to hang out with, just things that we take for granted as, individuals, like not having your phone ring ever and seeing people on Instagram having fun, even people you just left, hanging out together. And, he's like, wait a minute, I saw all these people. How come, I'm not there? So he sees that all the time. So since he's home this semester, he's home this semester training from school because he couldn't get his mind off of Paris, about his performance in Paris. I said, the church, like, let me get him involved in a church group. And, because then there won't be, any of these issues of acceptance and inclusion and, all these things. So I found a local group. It's a youth group, well, young adult group that meets every single week, and it's led by a pastor and his wife, all very young. And so it's like a youth ministry where they hang out every week and chat and whatnot. There Iris and he's been doing this since January, I want to say. So I got a call from my daughter, who said that somebody's mom from that group reached out to her, saying that her daughter had an issue with my son, with Lawrence, and she wants you to talk to her. So I talked to the mom, and it was over some text messages. And the text messages, basically, the daughter thought that my son was trying to dictate her time. Like she said, and people with autism are very literal. If you tell them you're going to call them at 5, they're thinking that you're going to call them at 5. But Lawrence isn't that rigid, but he understands when, also, if he's being ghosted. He's pretty witty, but with and so the hours had gone by, and and whatnot, and he texts and he's like, are we still gonna talk? And then she's like, oh, I've got homework. I mean, just kind of excuses after excuses. But again, he understands what being ghosted, because it happens to him all the time. Like, so he knows what that feels like. But anyway, this girl said that she they would talk like the next day at like 11 a.m. So he talked to her then. I mean, no, they texted, and she was like, I'll have to call you in a little bit. And he was like, okay, but please hurry. And the way that she received that was that he was trying to dictate what she does with her time. And this is what the mom said to me. And this is over text messages. So it's not like he called angry, he was cursing. It was all text messages. So you could see the line. And the mom said that she'd been in a relationship where the guy, it wasn't a good one, and in my opinion of this, I feel like she was bringing in some feelings from another. And mind you, my son's not in a relationship with this girl, she's just another girl in the group, but she brought her past experiences into this particular situation. And him saying please hurry, it wasn't him telling her what to do with her time. The situation was, my son, who also rides motorbikes, was going to Buzz Creek, and he had to be there at noon, and he needed to leave our home by 11:15. So if she's going to call him at 11, They're only going to be able to talk for a few minutes before he has to leave at 11:15 to head out to Butts Creek. And so when I talk about what a community can do, it's like just not be so reactive, because he does it. He does have expressive and receptive communication disorder. And so his words are very short, his sentences are very, he just doesn't have the language. But like if it were somebody like me or you, we would have said, I have a hard stop at 11:15 because I have somewhere to be at noon. That would have been an acceptable response. That wouldn't have seemed like so, in your face or whatever. And when I explained that to the mom, she was like, "Oh, well, we would have understood that." Well, you have the capacity to understand anyway. Do we really have to be, to use PhD language in order for you to be compassionate and not go all the way left, with comment? Yeah. And so what she did was the daughter and the mom called the group and told them that the daughter felt threatened by him. But yes, I mean, it just went all this way. And I was annoyed at that fact, because I feel like your daughter is 25, 26 years old. And I understand her feeling, like kind of how she's feeling. But when you get other people involved, like he has a reputation, also. And we don't need, this. Like, we could have had this conversation. After I talked to the mom, she said she understood and that she would go back to the pastor and his wife and, share with them, what I was saying, because I just reframed the language that he used. But mind you, none of it was cursing, none of it was threatening. And he used the word consequences. He was like, "Well, there'll be consequences." And of course, she was like, "Well, that's a threat." But that's what I use for him. I tell him that there are consequences to all actions. The consequence of you leaving at 11:15, you leaving at 11:20 versus 11:15 means that you're not going to get there in time to do this thing. Same thing with swimming. Yeah, I mean, we say that with our boys. If you don't leave at this time, you're going to miss warm-ups, and you're not going to be able to dive. You're not going to be able to practice diving. You're not, like, there are consequences. But when he said that, she thought that he was threatening him. And so anyway, and I told her, I said, "I do find this problematic." And this was in a text message from me to the mom, that he's a part of this group too. And the mom was like, "This is a safe space for my daughter." Well, it's a safe space for my son as well. And the fact that she took this to, kind of externally is problematic. So last week I was going to an event and the pastor's wife called me and she said, "I understand that you wanted to talk to me." I didn't, but the mom called and said, I was like, "But while you're here, the way that we normally handle these situations, I would just remove Lawrence and we would go someplace else." But I told her, I said, "He's part of your flock also. And when you're talking to, these young adults about acceptance and whatnot, when you're talking about the Bible, what you do unto the least of these, he's the least of these, as ministers of this flock, he's one of yours. And this is a teachable opportunity. Like, you don't get to pick one side over the other when you've not even heard his side. There wasn't even a his side. And the language is the difference, that's used. And when I spoke to the pastor, well, it was him and his wife, because she called, but he was sitting there and he was listening. And he was like, "Well, now listening to what you're saying, everything that they told us makes sense." Like, because we knew something was weird. And he said, "We have so much fun when Lawrence is here." And he said, "I didn't know he had a disability," which is so strange, because some people, it's the first thing that they see. That's the first thing that they see. And then you have people like Chris and this pastor, they were like, "I didn't know." But it's the people that it's the first thing that they see. Those are the people that we struggle the most with. So, as a community, honestly, you don't have to know whether somebody has a disability or not to be able to offer some compassion or grace in a situation. Like, kind of check where you are in a situation, because as I mentioned to the pastor and his wife, this girl has a background, not a background, a history with domestic violence. And certain things are going to be triggering for her for the rest of her life, just as certain
That's
things are
right.
going to be triggering for my son. You know, people not on, you know, being
That's
who they
right.
are or honoring their word. Like, we're all going to have triggers. And it just sounds like she hasn't healed from a situation that she's been dealing with, but projecting it onto my son in a manner that could be, you know, harmful. You know, like, I think she too needs, you know, some level of work, not dismissing her feelings,
That's
but
right.
this could have been handled differently. So when I mentioned
Right.
that to the pastor, he was like, understood, you know, this is definitely a teachable moment. And so the way that this was resolved, the pastor, his wife, you know, myself and Lawrence, before he re-enters that group, we're going to go out to dinner. As you know, I'm going out of town for swim meet next week, but when we return, maybe once a week, we're going to go so they can learn Lawrence, learn how to best,
That's great.
you know, just recognize any nuances he may have, you
That's
know,
right.
like, and that way they can work with other people. But
But what this shares for me is that, and someone just wrote, I was literally about to say, what is such a blessing is that you are such a strong advocate and you are able to communicate, you know, on behalf of your son so that other people can hear you and listen and then have this different perspective, which is a wonderful thing. And sometimes people don't have that incredible advocate that you are, Dee.
yeah.
Like, you're an incredible advocate for your child. I now want to make sure that we open up the floor if anybody has a question for Dee or a comment or something you might be working through with one of your children or loved ones. Yes, I see a hand up. Please, you can come off of mute.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to say, first of all, thank you to this community, which has just been a godsend and a help for the last 5 years of my life. And also, I see that Dr. Linda is on the call. Wanted to say thank you for your guidance and support. About a year ago, you helped me help my son navigate the whole testing process. He had been going through therapy, and through his therapist, she suggested that he might perhaps have autism. And but rather than do a self-diagnosis, you know, we encouraged him to get tested. And that in and of itself was a journey because it's expensive, insurance didn't cover it, you know, all of those things. But long story short, he was diagnosed with level one autism, whatever that means, a year ago at age 27. And we have while he was somewhat relieved to finally be able to kind of define what he felt he knew all along were challenges and issues and to put a name to it, I am really struggling, and he is really struggling to figure out, why is it so difficult to find services for adults with autism? You know, we live in different states, but he's struggling to find kind of comprehensive care, because it's not just needing therapy for his anxiety. He seems to have a variety of medical gastrointestinal issues related to stress that he experiences. He just broke up with his girlfriend who he was living with after 5 years. So there are relationship challenges, and we just don't know where to find those resources to help him, you know, figure out what accommodations he might need. You know, he quit his job. I mean, just, it's so overwhelming. And all these years, it was just so strange to get a diagnosis at age 27 after he was a three-sport athlete and captain of every team. He graduated with honors from college. You know, there was just never any example or any diagnosis. And it seems like now, quite honestly, he feels like the burden is relieved. So he can do all of these things that are natural to him because he'd been masking all these years. So he stems, and he's, you know, he avoids social situations because, you know, he says, I've never been comfortable in them. And we just don't know how to help him. And we don't know how to help him access resources. And we don't even know how to process conversations with him because we just don't have the history, 27 years of what looked like a wonderful life and a productive one. And now it's just all confusing. So I don't know. But our biggest struggle is, why are services for adults with autism so hard to find?
See,
That
thank you for
is
your question, by
exactly.
the way.
Yes, thank you, Maria. And we still need to connect. Yes, it is very, very hard. And separately, I don't know if Kelly mentioned this, but I founded a nonprofit specifically for this issue of providing resources for families who fall in the gaps. And unfortunately, for Black males, it's usually behavioral. Like, they get the diagnoses late because they think that our kids are just bad. I mean, it's more behavioral, which is why my son went away, didn't have the disability diagnosis. The first thing is they look at the behaviors, the stimming, the social isolation, if it's by them or by their peers. But it doesn't go away. Like, when they turn 18 and the IEP falls off and the government resources fall off, the disability doesn't fall off. And finding resources, at least for my son, I've had to piecemeal it. Like, he works with, a sports psychologist, a psychologist, a GI doctor, because that's also common for people with autism to have GI issues. So we have a lot of medical professionals, chiropractor, he goes to yoga, Pilates, I'm doing all the things, keeping him away from dairy, probiotics to deal with the gut issues. Like, I'm really, fish oil for the brain, just so much. I see a comment from Michelle, and Kelly put the link to my organization in the chat. But if Dr. Linda wants to come off mute and talk about, because I know she does testing and she knows about autism resources. I don't know if she's still listening or not.
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, good morning.
I'm not coming on camera though, because my hair's not even combed, but I just
No problem.
wanted to just be here today, just, to support and really to honor Dee. Because and ever since I met her, she has just touched a place in me, because she's a lioness for her child. And she is such a strong champion. And it's just something about that ferocity that just I honor it, and I'm in awe of it. So every now and again, she probably thinks I'm really strange. I'll send her a note that says, "Girl, I see you out there hustling, and I see you, I do that all the time, don't I, D?"
You do, yeah.
Because I know, I've sit and watch mothers struggle. I mean, all of us with boys at some point in time have a struggle, but with these added challenges, your son being at the intersection of several things that in and of themselves would be, would threaten him, right? But you're fighting it all. So I mean, I just want to give you honor on this Easter Sunday. You have a heart of a lion, and I just admire you. I
Thank
mean,
you,
I really
Linda.
do. What I wanted to say about adult resources are challenging, because it's not just that they have the same issues, they have different issues. Because y'all see this show on Netflix about autism and dating, right? Like, they have the same hormones, the same desires, the same hopes that other people have, right? And it's hard for them to grow and develop in the social areas because of, the diagnosis itself, but also because of the way that the world doesn't fully incorporate them. Like, that church group was a perfect example, right? Of, it's supposed to be a social group, right? So, like, let all the kids come and socialize. But, a lot of our religious organizations, they don't have training to deal with differences. I will say this, they are starting to get better because the mental health situation, the fact that we recognize diversities right now in the society more, they're getting a little bit better, and they're knowing that they have to reach out and partner with mental health people a better. I want to just say this about the testing. D's story makes me sad. I'm not gonna lie or try to cut that with anything other than just the truth, right? Our children are still 3 years behind in autism diagnosis. No matter what we do, we haven't cut that gap. So we have children that are getting in the system with autism at two, right? And at three. And our children are still like typically first grade, you know? And even though to those of you who might be listening, that seems pretty young, it's not. Because as Dee talked about, Child Find and all of these services that you can apply to your children when they're two. I have there's one of the things in this country that we actually do pretty good at, right? Is that we have these services to come out to you and programs that you can avail yourself on so that you can work with your child while, before they hit school, right? And so those 3 years are really, really crucial. And Dee's sense of panic when she gets the first diagnosis of a middle schooler was appropriate because, usually, typically, even the ID diagnosis comes pretty early. So that's another thing. The thing that I want to, the last thing I want to talk about is what Dee said, talked about is behaviors. We categorize children as problematic. We look at what they have done versus what has been done to them and what kind of genetic factors are going. And we label all Black boy issues, mostly all Black boy issues, as behavioral. And so however, we try to fight that, right? When we try to fight it, they say, they think that Miss Sapp is being defensive because her son is misbehaving, right? And it's really hard to fight them. But what we know is that in the system, similar behaviors are labeled differently. Punishment has been given out for Black boys that other people are not punished for. So what you have to do is that you have to really champion for your children. You have to really say that I don't think that's an appropriate diagnosis, or I don't think, excuse me, I don't think those that is an appropriate suspension, right? And challenge that. And as parents, I would say look further in terms of what's causing the behavior. And I'll say that we are fighting our own issues with regard to our traumas. And it's sometimes it's hard for us to see. I have people tell me all the time, well, my child doesn't have his dad in his life. And I'm like, and I'll say, that could be traumatic. And they say, well, a lot of Black kids don't have them. But I'm like, that doesn't mean it's not traumatic. Right. Or their dads are in their lives in an inappropriate way. Right. The last thing I do want to say, Dee, and I want to go back to you because I feel like that you have such a richness of conversation about this. The testing is expensive. Right. And in the Northeast corridor, it can go anywhere from $4,000 to $10,000. Right. 10,000 in New York, 4 to 5 in D.C. A little bit less in Baltimore. But I would urge you all that if you can't afford it, first of all, to get independent testing. The school system, when they test, remember, they are trying to find ways to not provide services. And so what they diagnose, and I'm trying to be neutral, but what they diagnose, they have to remedy. So understand that that's the perspective that they're going to have in the testing, and they're under pressure to provide less services. So if you can't afford testing, put yourself on the list at Children's, put yourself on the list at Hopkins, Mount Washington in Baltimore. Those are just some of the places in the DMV. If you can't if you can't wait on their waiting list for 2 years, try to see if you can get a payment plan with a tester. Try to see what insurance covers. They will cover less educational issues, more ADHD and other developmental problems. So see what you can get through your insurance and try to get testing. If you can at all afford it, try to get independent testing.
No, I agree with Dr. Linda because that's literally what we did. I didn't wait on the school. I mean, they did theirs, but even now, every 3 years, we get him tested independently because they can't dispute something done by a licensed professional outside of that area. And I've always gone above and beyond because they did everything, the BOS testing, the Woodcock Johnson, like I made sure he got top tier everything. I mean, we still have problems. I mean, but it just wasn't as worse as it could be.
Well, I want to say thank you, Dr. Linda, for jumping in on that question. And Dee, you have been such an incredible, as someone just said, a lioness. You are a lioness for your child and for so many of our children, quite honestly, including my own, and so many people that you are a resource for. I did want to just share. Dee's organization is called Accessibility Bridge. So the link is in the chat, accessibilitybridge.com. There are tons of resources there as well. And I'm looking to see. And then Easter Seals, I put a link for them. They have some great resources and they have local offices all around the country. Dee, I want to give you the last word just to summarize on this beautiful Sunday morning. Anything that you would, any last advice you would share with parents who are on this
Honestly,
journey?
yeah, the example that I gave about the church is, teach people how what acceptance looks like for your child. Don't allow people to put a blanket over everything, just to say all disabilities matter. I mean, of course they do, but in this space at this moment, this is what my child needs. And if your child is 28, 38, 58, whatever that is, you're still their mom. Like I still show up for my son as his mom, and he's 23. And I don't leave, until I say what I have to say, because at the very least, this is my concern. If something ever happens to him, I don't want someone to say that they didn't know. So they don't have to listen to me. But if something happens to him, I make them understand that yes, he's 23, but I could be a witness, a bystander, whatever. Don't say you didn't know, because I'm sharing
Absolutely.
with you that, he's anxious in this moment. He does not feel safe in this moment. Because you did this, this is, I make it very clear. I'll even put it in writing. I'll follow up with an email. But I think when you're talking about advocating for your children, no matter how old they are, insert yourself in that space to let people know what your loved one needs in that moment and moving forward. And
That's
I
right.
think once people see how them not doing it could potentially impact them, we'll see some changes.
I love that. It's advocating and teaching, as Dr. Vicky says, what acceptance looks like for your child, no matter how old they are. That's awesome. Well, thank you, Dee, for being here and shedding such a light on this topic. Really appreciate you and your friendship and your leadership of all these organizations, including the Sunrise Project. Really love you and appreciate you. And thank you again.
Thank you, Kim.
And I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Vicki Johnson, who will close us out on this beautiful Easter Sunday.
Thank you, Kelly. Thank you, Dee. This was amazing. Thank you, Dr. Linda, for adding. Your value is always God. We thank you for this Resurrection Sunday. Thank you for the Sunrise Project and this support community, for the wisdom that you consistently pour into our lives, into our hearts, into our minds. Thank you that you have given us all sufficiency in all things unto every good work. Thank you for the wisdom to train up and parent our children. That you have given to us as gifts, because you said in your word that children are an inheritance from you. So thank you for the blessings of each of our children, for the wisdom to parent them, for the resources and sources of support that you provide for us, one being this community. Continue to bless Dee as she leads the way, as she blazes trails in the advocacy space on behalf of her son and on behalf of other children. Thank you for her leadership. Thank you for the open doors and opportunities that you have blessed her with to be a voice, a necessary voice. God, we give you praise and honor. We pray for every family, every household, every mom on this call, those listening and those who will listen to the replay line who needed to hear what was shared today. We honor you. We bless you. We thank you that you will continue to protect and preserve us, God. And until we come again next week, keep us safe. Don't let our chain be broken. And we honor you and give you praise in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Amen. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Dee. Thank you, Dr. Vicky. Have a beautiful, beautiful Sunday and a great week. And we'll see you next Sunday, 9 a.m. Eastern, here at the Sunrise Project. Thank you so much. Have a beautiful day. Mm-hmm.